Lots of things are better together. Hockey, food, golf, synchronized swimming, tailgates before a college football game, late night karaoke, especially late night karaoke. There is nothing better than a duet of summer love, and I can assure you that. But if you really want to take things to the next level, drink some Labatt Blue Lights with your friends and live life to the power of we. Always enjoy responsibly. Beer, Labatt USA, Buffalo, New York.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You're listening to DraftKings Network.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Gojo and Golic. Mike Golic Jr., Mike Golic Sr., Emerson Lazio holding it down in the DraftKings studio in Boston for us right now, which means we've got a great show coming up for you guys. As always, download, subscribe, rate, review it, leave us a five-star rating, and check us out here live Monday through Friday from 8 to 10 a.m. Eastern on the DraftKings Network, noon to 1 p.m. Eastern, wherever you hear VSiN on the radio. Strap in today, folks. Emerson, what do we got coming up on the show?
All right, big man. We're getting weird. We're getting odd in the NBA. Oddballs Amin El-Hassan will join the show. I believe it's going to be in studio, according to my source. Pitching in, former MLB pitcher Rob Dibble weighing in on the smorgasbord of pitching injuries and no buts about it. UFL weekend. We got a week three preview with the one, the only, Jake But gentlemen, where we will start this show, O.J. Simpson, the once beloved NFL superstar and Hollywood actor who was acquitted in a 1995 murder trial that gripped the nation, died at his Las Vegas home on Wednesday. He was 76. So Simpson, whose fame, fortune, and legacy were forever changed despite being cleared by an L.A. jury of killing his ex-wife and her friend Ron Goldman in what was dubbed the trial of the century, had been battling prostate cancer. Weird life, weird legacy for sure. Senior, you're a little bit on the older side here, so what do you remember about where you were on the night of the Bronco chase and on the day of the verdict? So that's October 3rd, 1995. Take us there right now.
Yeah, the crossover to my career and the OJ situation was, I was pretty close to it. You know, my last year in the NFL was 1993 with the Miami Dolphins. And at that point, OJ was a sideline reporter for NBC. And he actually did a couple of my games. I talked to him a few times, you know, when you talk to, as you know, Mike, when you do games, you talk to the analysts and the reporters. Did the game, my Cleveland Dolphin game in Cleveland. And I believe the game on Thanksgiving in Dallas. So I saw him and listen, that was literally months before the murders in June. This was in 93. So before the murders in June of 94. And at that point in June of 94, I wasn't on a team, but I was running and trying to prepare. But I certainly had a lot of time. I wasn't in an off-season program. So, you know, I was at home with my wife, with Chris, when the chase was going on. And then we got to the trial in November. I had run for a couple of teams, but I wasn't signed by anybody. So again, just kind of hanging out. And then as we went into 95, you know, we went into the trial into 95. I think it went till October 95. That's when I got into the sports broadcasting and sports media. So I went from seeing him as a player to now, while I was doing college games for ESPN, I was doing radio actually out here in Arizona, morning radio. And of course, the topic du jour was O.J. Simpson. So that's what we were talking about, you know, at all times was O.J. It's, I mean, my God, it probably started reality TV with this trial. So I'm on a CNN called yesterday and asked me to do a hit for them about it. And on that same interview was Bob Costas, the great Bob Costas. I had never heard this story, guys, and I was sitting there amazed when he was telling it. So he said, when they asked Bob about the situation and the slow car chase with Al Collins driving the white Bronco was in June. That was during the NBA playoffs. Bob Costas calls the NBA playoff games for NBC. OJ from the white Bronco was trying to call Bob Costas. He was trying to call him at home because Bob didn't have a cell phone. This is just when cell phones were coming out. And I think OJ was actually using one of those old brick car phones. He was trying to call Bob Costas at home. Bob obviously wasn't there. And since OJ worked for NBC, he got the number to the truck, the transmission truck at the game Bob Costas was doing. He called the truck and talked to somebody in the truck. And they said, OJ said, I got to talk to Bob Costas. And the guy's like, he's getting ready to do a game. He's not here. And he said, no, I got to talk to him now. And he said, he's not here. And then the guy said, who is this? And OJ said, it's OJ Simpson. And the guy said, yeah, right. And hung up on OJ when he was in the white Bronco because he thought it was a joke and never told Bob about it. Right. So then OJ gets arrested in November of 94 and he's in jail. And OJ had Bob come to the jail. It was Bob Costas, Al Collins, and Kardashian, one of the lawyers. Those are the only three visiting OJ at the jail. And OJ said, I tried to call you. And Bob's like, well, you know, whatever, you know, I never got the message. I had no idea. Why were you trying to call me? And OJ said to him, I was being defamed and I wanted you, since you're a friend of mine, to kind of, you know, have my honor here, you know, and he said, not really about the situation, but about my entire life and football and everything. And Bob, on the interview yesterday, Bob said, well, OJ, I wouldn't have been able to, you know, do that. I would have had to ask you some questions. And then, of course, the right thing to do, the CNN interviewer yesterday said, well, what would you have asked him? And he said, I would have tried to find the best way I could have asked him of, did you do this? And he goes, I would have expected him to say no. And if he said no, I think Bob Costa said, I would have asked him, well, innocent people don't normally write suicide notes, and innocent people don't have a gun and are threatening to kill themselves. So he was like, you know, I'm not really sure what I was going to believe here. But that was the interaction. So OJ was actually on the phone in the Bronco in that slow chase trying to call Bob Costas. That was amazing to me to hear. But listen, I mean, and on Twitter, you knew this obviously blew up on Twitter yesterday. Mike and I read tweets about leave the man be, you know, just worry about his family, let him rest in peace. And my thought was, it can't happen that way. This, when you say OJ Simpson before his football career, you're going to say Bronco chasing murders. I mean, that's what you're going to say. So as I said in the interview yesterday, that you can't separate those. Everybody has an opinion. I have the opinion. I think he did it. A lot of people have the opinion of that. And there are those that said, hey, he got acquitted. So, you know, we don't think he did it. But it's never going to leave. It's going to be one of the first things after the OJ Simpson comma, what said next. But man, like, I was amazed at that Bob Costas story. That was unreal.
I think that story underscores, though, what a insane cultural phenomenon, what a moment in time that was. That, because coming off the top here, listening to Emerson list all that stuff, you're coming on the show and trying to figure out today, how do you go about tackling a subject like this? What you said, Dad, OJ Simpson largely going to be viewed as someone everyone believes got away with murder and also was a prolific football player. And in this day and age had been still very out in the open, making content openly in the face of all these people that felt this type of way about OJ Simpson. But like, how do you explain that to a generation now that's come up without this? You know, we had the OJ Made in America documentary on ESPN, which, man, if you hadn't watched it already, now would be a great time to go back and watch what could be one of the best modern sports documentaries documentaries or documentaries of any kind that kind of underscores this. But Dad, I think people who weren't alive for that moment trying to digest what you just described of, oh no, we were all trained around watching this happen in real time. Also because of the fact that when this happened, like Dad, I think the hardest thing for people to understand also is what O.J. Simpson represented as a football player and as a star in America at that point because of his football exploits. And that's, I thought, what the documentary did a really good job of was making you understand how transcendent O.J. was at that time as a football player and as a star, and then for this to be the thing that derailed, you know, he derailed his life with.
I mean, and remember, he obviously was acquitted on this for the unbelievable scene of, you know, if it don't fit, you have to acquit, you know, of having to try on a tight glove anyway over a rubber glove, like a surgical glove. I mean, that just kind of blew up the case there. And I don't think even still, a lot of people don't remember this a whole lot or were young, is he got acquitted of that, but ended up still going to jail for armed robbery and kidnapping in Las Vegas, or he thought some people had some of his memorabilia that they shouldn't have had it. So he went and tried to steal it back from these people and actually went to prison for that. I mean, so, and then listen, the trial, like I said, I think was the start of reality TV. You remember all the characters, Judge Ito with all the different clocks, you know, that were on, you know, on his desk where he was. Everybody became a star in their own way. And oddly enough, every person, every attorney on the defense team for OJ has passed away from cancer. They're all gone. Every one of them has passed away. OJ was the last one, and all from cancer. This was, like I said, reality TV. This was all individual stars. This was following every person on the prosecution team, the defense team, the judge, after this trial, of what they were doing, of where they went. This was the biggest thing, and it lasted. The trial started in what, November of 94, and I think went till October of 95. So it lasted a long time. And this was, I mean, every single day you were riveted to the TV, just listening to the mounds and mounds of evidence and questions and witnesses. It was incredible. It really was. And I mean, listen, because you separate, if you can separate, this guy was one of the great football players there was. I mean, he was an unbelievable football player, went on to the acting career, all the commercials that he's done as well. But again, this is the first thing you'll obviously remember about him. And listen, it's still going on. He did lose in civil court to the Goldmans to the tune of $33 million in a wrongful death. The Goldmans have gotten maybe 100-some thousand of that, and it accrues over the years when the payout isn't around. So that 30 hasn't happened. So that $33 million today is up to around $96 million that is owed to them. And who knows if they'll ever see a penny. I mean, we see other people who lose civil suits and have to pay money and find a way. He moved to Florida where the laws are a little better to be able to, quote unquote, hide your money. So, I mean, there's still ancillary things going on with this.
There are. And I wonder now, like you said, though, how much of that even continues at this point? Because, again, this has always been the same thing it drew back to. Every time you saw OJ in public, every time you saw him on a podcast or going on Twitter, which he had become really well known for in the recent years, it just immediately went back to this source. And what you're describing now, and I think the circumstances around the reaction to his death yesterday, Bomani Jones put it best, we kind of got to find out what it would have been like to have Twitter when all that stuff went down, because everyone was just getting out the things they thought then. You're right, there was, I shouldn't say not any mourning. There was some very strange stuff. I mean, the Heisman Trust putting out the tweet mourning the loss of O.J. Simpson, just underscoring the ridiculous nature that Reggie Bush currently doesn't have a Heisman right now because he lived in the wrong house while he was at USC. But this man was accused of literal murder and somehow still allowed to keep his Heisman, and is someone that they would honor after his death in that way, is wild to see. There were a bunch of young I saw Todd Gurley had a tweet glowingly praising O.J. Simpson in ways that just don't make sense and seem to largely ignore. Like, you can, I understand that if you're someone that had a personal relationship with this person, maybe today can be a little bit different. But man, I do feel like there's still a level of read the room that has to go on, because this person's larger than life, Dad. This person represents something that's bigger than anyone's relationship with them. And I think that's why, to some people, this reaction might have felt callous, but for a lot of people, that felt earned.
You know, Mike, it's tough for me to get on anybody, because it did seem wild. Like I read, you saw the Todd Gurley tweet and others, but these guys are young, right? Like you were a kid when this was all going on. You can't ask them to, they're not going to go back and watch all this, rewatch it, or maybe read. I mean, the amount you could read on it, they just see a guy who, and I'm not saying this in a bad way to them, but there are those who are younger that see a guy, understand, wow, look what happened here with this Chase. He was accused of murder. And oh, by the way, he was acquitted. So there are people who weren't around for this situation, didn't see everything going on, could form their opinion based on all of that, like I gave mine, and can just say, well, this guy was accused of murder. He was acquitted. So obviously he was innocent. So now, you know, I'm going to mourn the football player, you know, and his family. So it's tough for me to really get on anybody. And listen, everybody has their own opinion. They're allowed to, and there may be, I'm sure there's people who knew the whole situation and still, you know, say, hey, he was acquitted. He didn't do it. Leave the man alone. But certainly a younger generation who wasn't around for any of this and only kind of see the headlines, accused of murder, Bronco Chase, acquitted of that. You know, I can see how they would maybe just go to the football side and say, you know, great football player, great loss.
There were two trials, like when I was growing up. I was around 10, 11 at the time. I remember it was appointment television in my household. We'd sit around the table, the dinner table. We'd flip on and we would watch Deborah Norville on Inside Edition, and it was the Nancy Kerrigan trial, and then it was also the O.J. Simpson trial. Seriously, every single night, my sister and I and my parents would sit around and eat twice-baked potatoes, and we'd dial into this television program to get caught up on everything that's happened. Like, we were glued to our TV every night, and I'm 10 and 11. I don't understand a single thing. I'm like, isn't this the football player? Like, I couldn't wrap my mind around what I was watching.
Yeah, I think to that point, Emerson, and to Dad's point, you're right. There are a lot of people that maybe can't fully comprehend this because they were either young when it happened or they were so young that they weren't alive when it happened. But I think if you have digested anything related to OJ, then if you're a person coming from that way, I don't know how the headline isn't anything other than man who got away with murder and also played football passes away. That seems to be like O.J. Simpson largely seemed like a flawed person who was linked to this incredibly heinous crime and trial. And oh, by the way, he played football. Like, Dad, that to me, the football's the throwaway, regardless of how great he was.
Yeah.
It's just so far down on the list of things that I perceive when I think about O.J. Simpson and I think about what his legacy is now as he has passed away.
Yeah, that's the other thing, too, because his football career ended so long ago as well, right? And people really, really had to go back and see, okay, what kind of football player was he? You know, for those that didn't know a lot about him and then saw the start of his trial and dove into it a little bit and had to look back and see what kind of player he was. He's a great player. He's a great player at USC. He's a great player for, you know, his career with the Buffalo Bills. But that is going to get lost, because certainly this was one of the biggest things ever. And like I said, after the comma after his name, the trial and the Bronco chase are going to be first. And that's understandable. I get it. But again, different generations are going to see this differently. It was one of the, we'd say most complicated lives out there. It was a great life for a while. Dude had everything he wanted. He was, when you're a star in California, like he was at USC, before he even got to the NFL, and then he's in movies as well. This guy was about as big as could be, right? What a place to be a star in California at that time. And then, to have it go all the other way, the way it did, and again, have most people like myself, I don't know what you guys think, who do think he did it. It's an incredible, incredible life that it is interesting now to kind of step back because I know how involved I was with it and watching and being around it at that time, but to see how other people are digesting it, whether they're older than me, same age as me, a little bit younger than me, or way younger than me, of how they all see the situation.
I think the thing that I take away from it is that I do believe, based on what I saw, that he was guilty, that he was acquitted of a crime that he did commit, but then also went about his freedom in a way that almost seemed to throw it in everybody's face. You'd think someone in that position might shy away, might go back into themselves. And instead, OJ decided, no, he was going to live just as loud as he wanted to, despite everything else that had happened, in a way that felt defiant. And I think made a lot of people continually uncomfortable right up until the end. So an incredibly complicated legacy for one of the most polarizing figures in modern American history. All right, guys, let's talk about Jägermeister. They could have written a totally normal ad here, like a really classic ad. They could have talked about their history, the 56 botanicals. It could have been all salesy and cutesy, but they know you don't care. Jägermeister doesn't want to be like all those other ads you've seen and heard. They just wanted to say two things. Jägermeister is great, but everyone has been drinking it wrong. Damn, that's cold.
Drinking it wrong? All right, if that's the case, how should we be drinking it?
They are so glad you asked, and so am I, Dad. I'm here to help you. Ice cold is the answer, at 0 degrees Fahrenheit to be exact. Ice cold shots of Jägermeister. That's it. That's all they want to tell you. So, wherever you are, if you're hanging out with friends or at the bar, call the shots. Cheers with ice cold shots of Jägermeister. Damn, that's cold. And remember to check out Jägermeister at www.draftkingsxjagermeister.com. Remember, drink responsibly. Jägermeister Liqueur, 35% alcohol by volume, imported by Mast Jägermeister US, White Plains, New York.
All right, folks, check this out. After being turned down by the latest top tier head coach, so that's Baylor's Scott Drew, Kentucky basketball reportedly closing in on one of its own to take over the program. No, not like the first or second, third, fourth, maybe not even the fifth choice. Wildcats are finalizing a 5-year deal with BYU's Mark Pope. Sources telling ESPN on Thursday. So he played two seasons at Kentucky, won a national title there, Gojo. He's taken BYU to a couple NCAA tournaments in his 5 years at the helm. But again, this poor guy, I mean, the money on the contract, that will definitely help you forget the fact that you weren't their first choice. Maybe not even their fourth or fifth here.
So I think the interesting part about this dad for the reception isn't going to be, oh, that he was the fourth or fifth choice. Like, that's showbiz. He understands that getting into coaching and someone who came up in athletics, you're not always going to be that, but you're going to be ready for any opportunity. I would be curious, Dad, if the part that stings is going to be what I think is going to be a largely tepid reception from Big Blue Nation, who seemed to be in shambles yesterday, watching this incredibly proud blue blood basketball program get turned down by coach after coach for a job that they all believe is great, and now one of their own sons is coming back to coach, and nobody seems excited about it. And that part has to suck if you're going back to coach at your alma mater.
Well, yeah, it does. From both sides of this, first, Kentucky Nation, you would think you're still one of those that it's a job that coaches are going to want. You got turned down for them, so that part of it you feel snubbed a bit. But for him, I mean, you're right, Mike. We've seen this. You know, this isn't the first time a first or second or third choice has turned it down. He's going to the fourth, fifth, or lower choice to get there. But coaches have the confidence in the fact that obviously he played there and that they can build a program. To me, one of the problems is going to be the opposite of what Calipari is going to face at Arkansas. He's going to Arkansas with a clean slate, with a billionaire behind him, who gave him a lot of money and is going to give, you know, the NIL is going to be stocked. You know, like the Christmas stockings, you know, and they're going to be able to go out and get players. And Cal has a reputation and is going to be able to get players. I don't know what's going to happen here. Cal was already kind of complaining a bit that maybe the support was waning in Kentucky as far as that stuff was concerned. So how much is this new guy going to get? You know, even though we played there, is there going to be the, oh, yeah, let's fill the coffers so he can go get the players? So that's my concern. The coach and having the ability, we talk about this in the NFL all the time. Coaches think they can make players better because that's what they do. They coach. So this coach is going to think, I can go there and I can succeed. I have the confidence in my abilities as a coach to make this succeed. But to do that, you're going to need some great players. And I wonder if that's going to be the issue of him being able to have them. They may say they want to come there, but can they get paid now in this era of free agency in college sports? So I think he's on obviously a different plane than Cal going to Arkansas.
Yeah. Oh, it's an entirely different thing, because part of the thing for Kentucky and their retort to Cal, it seemed, when he was there was, well, you want all of this stuff resource-wise, but where have our wins been in this recent part of your tenure here? In the last few years of it, we haven't been going to Final Fours every year. We haven't won a national championship again. So why are we going to pony up all this money to support you like that? And now you're saying, all right, why would we do that for a guy that's won exactly zero tournament games so far? And I understand for Mark Pope, I saw plenty of people around college basketball who said, this man comes in well-regarded from an X's and O's standpoint. They played an exciting style of offense at BYU. There are all these things you can point to that would be positives from a coaching standpoint. But in terms of what you mentioned, that's the reality of modern college athletics, is unless you're willing to pony up and do this, and now you're basically asking Kentucky to do this sight unseen based on faith, not by anything they've actually gotten as a tangible result, all while coping with the reality that you brought up, Dad, that I think is one of the most interesting moments of soul searching that happens in sports, is when you figure out, oh, are we not what we perceive ourselves to be? Like that thing that came up for Notre Dame when Brian Kelly left for LSU, and Notre Dame fans had to reckon with, wait a minute, are we not the end destination for somebody anymore? That's sort of a come to Jesus moment for a fan base and an institution.
Well, guys, he had a good first year in the Big 12. The problem is, no matter who was going to take this job, was going to have their work cut out for him, because you had their star freshman declaring for the draft, multiple other dudes hitting the transfer portal, other recruits who have committed to Kentucky have since backed off of that their pledges up to this point. So this is not going to be an easy transition for that program, that's for sure.
No, it's not, and that stuff has happened. We have seen decommits when coaches have gone, or players that will leave. Some players will leave Kentucky maybe and go to Arkansas. But, Mike, to your point, I agree. There is that realization. We did have it at Notre Dame. We never had a coach leave and coach somewhere else. It was either they were fired or retired. And now Brian Kelly, you know, and he has, you know, it's his choice to do what he wants. He left because all that was missing in his resume, it was a national championship, and he felt he had a better chance year after year of getting it at LSU. So, yeah, that is a realization. And then when you see coaches turn it down and turn it down and turn it down. But to me, the biggest thing now is the administration, they have to back this guy, right? They have to. They can't say, well, we have to wait and see what you do. Well, to wait and see what we do, I got to do it with players. I got to do it with resources. So to show you what I can do, I need the resources to do what I can do, to show you what I can do. So kind of that domino effect that administration has got to get on board with.
Well, I think one of the interesting parts about this is what that support manifests itself and what Mark Pope's approach to this will be, because we talked about in this day and age, can you win as much with one-and-done talent? Doing it the way Cal did, we were talking about, would he have needed to change his approach even if he had stayed the way it looked like he was in line to after the season? And would Mark Pope coming in be in a position to where maybe it's, all right, you're not going to get as much one-and-done talent. Like, I certainly don't think you're going to have the number one class year after year like you did with Cal, just because that is so tied to him, even if Kentucky itself is always going to be a draw. But now with that, would it come maybe, all right, a program that's more predicated on a little bit of stability, multi-year guys, and could that somehow, in a weird roundabout way, get them closer to the result that they're looking for in this current landscape of college basketball? I don't know. That's probably a lot of spin to try and galaxy brain this into being a good decision.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And we'll just have to wait and see. You know, again, you got guys that played at Kentucky for Cal now throwing their weight behind Cal at Arkansas. I mean, so guys that played for him, I mean, that had the year, the 1 year or whatever years at Kentucky, following the coach, not the school. You know, and we've always talked about all athletes get told this, don't go to the school for the coach. Well, hell, that's easier said than done. There are a hell of a lot of and I'll stay with the two mains, basketball and football, that go somewhere because of the coach. Because the coach gets players here or there or to the next level, and that's what they want to see. So that's an interesting part, as well as players who played for this coach in Calipari are now following him to Arkansas. That's another kind of a damning thing if you're a Kentucky fan.
I was going to say, the real nightmare scenario for Kentucky is seeing some of those guys that were in your uniform, that love your university, but have also always been linked to Cal. Like, that's the one thing, you see Cal all the time at NBA games supporting the guys that played for him. There is a very public and overt idea of maintaining those relationships. And the first time you see one of those guys show up at an Arkansas practice draped in that cardinal with the hog on their chest, I'd imagine that's going to be a shot to the heart for a lot of people. Because, Dad, to your point, players are extremely loyal if it's a coach that they love, who they believe has done right by them. And by all accounts, it seems like these players do have a good relationship with John Calipari, and you certainly love your alma mater still, but you're right. I mean, John Calipari is the guy that I'm sure a lot of them look at and say, helped make me a life-changing sum of money in the NBA, so why wouldn't I continue to support him?
Right. Yeah, completely agree. So, you know, new guy, tough go, right? I mean, he's excited, and he should be. He gets to go coach at his alma mater. Listen, a lot of these coaches love to go back to their schools and coach. He gets the chance, certainly, from a reputational standpoint of the two schools. It's a monster step up. But, you know, it could be to be careful what you wish for. Let's see how it all goes, and let's see if you can last there for a little while and build something. And hopefully, like I said, he gets help from the administration.
A new Pope in Kentucky getting ready to lead the charge. I've wanted to say that all morning.
Yeah.
The 82-game preseason is in the books, and it's finally time for the real season. Don't miss out on any of the NBA playoff action at DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NBA. From the play-in tournament all the way through the finals, DraftKings Sportsbook has you covered with same-game parlays, live betting, odds boosts, and so much more. So whether you're bought in on Heat culture at this point or think the Boston Celtics can survive a bump in the road, we got options for you. Just download the DraftKings Sportsbook app and use code GOJO. New customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets instantly. That's code GOJO, only on DraftKings. The crown is yours. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER, or in West Virginia, visit www.1800gambler.net. In New York, call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY. That's 467-369. In Connecticut, help is available for problem gambling. Call 888-789-7777 or visit ccpg.org. Please play responsibly. On behalf of Boot Hill Casino and Resort in Kansas, 21 plus, age varies by jurisdiction. Void in Ontario. Bonus bets expire 168 hours after issuance. See dkng.co/bball for eligibility and deposit restrictions, terms, and responsible gaming resources.
Welcome back to Gojo and Golic. Mike Golic Jr., Mike Golic Sr., and Emerson Lazzia. We're having a morning around here. We're excited. Aminel Hassan's going to be joining Emerson in studio in Boston. Him and Charlotte from Oddball are both out in Boston this week, so that's awesome. We're excited to talk some NBA action with him. We have a ton of games, by the way, coming up tonight. It feels like everyone plays tonight, and then obviously Sunday, the last game of the regular season, that'll mark it for everybody, but lots still at stake there. We can get it, take stock of the postseason with him. Jake Butt, who's coming on later also, the former Michigan tight end. He's on the call for these UFL games now, which is exciting, but certainly want to talk with him about, you know, J.J. McCarthy and the rise that he's had this spring, what Jim Harbaugh's doing at the next level already in the future at his alma mater at Michigan. But we've also got problems to contend with right now, because my dad is in a house without any Wi-Fi this morning and is over there, a man alone on an island, trying to negotiate with a whole bunch of technology that is just betraying him left and right, all while we're trying to talk about, like, O.J. Simpson dying and Kentucky naming a new coach. We're getting ready to talk about Shohei Ohtani's translator being accused of an insane level of fraud with multi-million dollars, and my dad's over here basically on bootleg cell service in the desert.
Yeah, just know I got the AirPod in. It just popped up. I got 5% left. That's going to go out in a minute. I tried to connect these headphones to the phone, and when you start it, it tells you what it's connected to. I swear it said it's connected to every single device I have in this house except for my phone. So that didn't work. So just know in a couple of minutes, all of a sudden, it's going to be the speaker of the phone. And yeah. This is your mother is trying her damnedest to help, because I'm of no use at all in this situation.
I just imagine, remember the video? This is Go ahead.
This is the old parable of teach him, you know, the give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. My dad, when it comes to technology, has decided he just wants to be given fish. He has never once displayed an aptitude to want to learn how to fish when it comes to this. And so now you're in this boat starving because at every turn when we've tried to help teach you something, you decided that you didn't want to do it. And so now you're in this situation where nobody can help you and you can't help yourself.
I'm not only starving, there's a hole in the boat. I mean,
that's a story in the Bible. Jesus is like, bros, cast the net. Except it's you in the boat that's sinking. You cast the net, you pull it in. Jesus is like, just kidding, bro. Gotcha.
Oh, it's incredible. So Dad's taking on water right now, currently inside the boat.
It's the Titanic.
As we've got a... Yeah. It's a lot. We're crossing a lot of metaphors right now. Mercifully, we're getting some help right now here as we've got Major League Baseball to talk about here. Rob Dibble, kind enough to join us, former Major League pitcher, host of the Rob Dibble Show on Fox Sports Radio, our old teammate at ESPN. Rob, thank you for the time this morning. My dad's really struggling, so he needed your help today.
Guys, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
thanks, Dib. You're saving me here, but help us as well, because Mike and I were talking about the elbow injuries, the Tommy John surgeries of the baseball players, not only in Major League, but starting at a young age. But let's focus first on Major League Baseball. The union trying to say we need to look at the pitch clock. The league saying, hey, we had a study from John Hopkins that it wasn't the pitch clock. Where are we and what do you think is going on?
Well, you can't say it's not the pitch clock. It's only been there for 2 years. But I've been researching this for 25 years with the best orthopedic surgeons in the business, well before this rash of injuries, because I've been working with high school pitchers for the last 20 years, and I still coach 15U and 16U AAU. We go to a ton of tournaments and stuff like that. And everybody on my team pitches, by the way, because when we go to a tournament, we'll play 5 games in 1 weekend. So everybody, even if you have to contribute an inning, I don't let my pitchers go by a certain, you know, pitch count, because there's certain things that I factor in. And it's your warmups, like your long tossing before the game, you're in the bullpen warming up. I count all of those pitches, because now let's take a major league guy. Major league guys, you know, you're doing your warmup, you're doing 30 long tosses, 50 in the bullpen. You're already at 80. You've already thrown 80 throws. Now you get in the game and these guys throw 100 max effort pitches by the fifth inning. You're at about 200 for that day. That's a lot. If you listen to Dr. Andrews, and I talk to all these guys, I'll give you an example. Dr. Craig Morgan out of Maryland, who did Curt Schilling's surgery years ago, and many, many other big leaguers. He did a 20-year study, and of 300 Tommy John recipients, all 300 had loose scapulas. So that's where you start. You start with the shoulder, you get to the elbow, and you know, you've got a lot of problems. And so then you've got all these velocity camps out there and ranches, and you've got 12 to 15 year old kids thinking I need to throw 90 miles an hour by the time I'm 17 years old. That's insane. When I was in high school, I maxed out around 90 and you guys know this as well as I do, because I've been studying this stuff since I retired. Your growth plates in your arm don't finish developing till you're in your 20s. And Dr. James Andrews just came out and said this. And so if you're going to lift weights, if you're going to have like those stupid water things or throwing a 25-pound medicine ball over your shoulder, you're destroying the growth plates in your arm. And now your ligament has to pick up all the excess weight, and it can't handle it. It's just a little ligament. You've got little ligaments in your shoulder and your labrum. I ruptured my labrum. That's what ended my career. So, you know, you put all of those things together, and, you know, then we don't allow recovery time. I don't want my kids to play 10 months a year. As a major leaguer, I played 6 months a year. So you've got kids playing 9, 10 months. They never have time to recover. So, you know, you guys didn't play football 10 months a year. NFL guys didn't play 10 months a year. You'd explode. So I just think that, you know, there's so many different factors in here. The pitch clock is like the last thing. I think about when I'm thinking about. That's just a bell and whistle for Rob Manfred. You know, let's bigger bases, no contact at second or home, you know, pitch clocks, all these different ridiculous things. That's not going to stop these elbow injuries. The elbow injuries are really the last 20 years of everybody trying to throw 100 miles an hour and all of this other stuff that you throw in there.
So, Rob, with that in mind, and we've only got a couple of minutes left here, is there any way to put the toothpaste back in the tube on that? Like, what would you – I know you're doing it personally, but is there anything that could be done broadly to help start to curb this?
Absolutely. I mean, first, with bullpens, you know, with my 15 and 16-year – when I threw a bullpen, I was just hitting locations. My whole, you know, as 13 years as a professional and 8 in the major leagues, you're not throwing max effort. You're just hitting spots. The best pitchers I ever saw were the Tommy Johns, the Don Suttons, the Gaylord Perrys, you know, Jamie Moyer. Guys that were spot pitchers are the best in my mind. A lot of guys could throw 100. That's not pitching. That's throwing. That's like, it's a carnival act. You know, I was watching the Red Sox game last night. And here's the last thing I'll say, because I know we're not have a lot of time. The last 20 years, even high school pitchers, they throw 60 to 70% off speed stuff and 30% fastballs. When I played in the major leagues, I threw 90% fastballs and 10% breaking balls. Watch any major league game. And Garrett Cole, Scherzer are very, those are some of the few guys that still throw 70, 80% fastballs. Every other major league starting pitcher is going to throw 60 or 70%. And we're talking circle changes, 90 miles an hour. That's absurd. A circle change is supposed to be 80. You know, a curveball is supposed to be in the 80 mile an hour range, 85 miles an hour. Everybody wants to throw 90, 95, 100 with, and I've done, listen, I do the Rapsodo. I do the spin rates and all of that stuff. The gyro spin. I know all of that stuff. And all of this is creating a mindset that I have to throw every pitch 100%. That's absurd. When you throw a bullpen, you throw it about 60 to 70%. You know, when you warm up for a game, 60, 70%. You don't get to max effort till you're facing your first live hitter.
It's fascinating, and we could listen to you talk all day about this. It's incredibly helpful. We appreciate all this time and insight, Rob. Thank you, and hopefully there can be more done so that we don't see so many of the great stars of today sidelined with more and more of these surgeries.
Get Tom House on. He's the best. Tom Brady was a client. Nolan Ryan was a client. Tom House is the foremost best pitching coach out there.
Gojo, you thought you were bad at betting. Shohei Ohtani's ex-interpreter, Ipe Mizuhara, lost more than $40 million through sports betting over a 26-month span, according to a bombshell criminal complaint released by federal prosecutors yesterday. Worst sports bettor who ever lived was charged with federal bank fraud after being accused of stealing more than $16 million from Ohtani to cover gambling debts here. So, Gojo, in total, he won just north of $142 million, but lost $182 million through the illegal bookmaker, who is $40 million richer now. What do you think? There was a $10 bet in there as well. Everyone's like, what was the $10 bet?
I know everyone looking at the stats that came out of this. Front Office Sports was the account that tweeted it. The average wager for Ipe was about $12,800. The largest wager, $160,000. And the smallest wager was $10. And yeah, everyone looking for this much volume and this many bets per day, what possibly he could have thrown $10 on. There were also people, because in this large, extensive report that was released, there was a few interesting things that came out of actual substance, like the fact that there's still no evidence that there was any money or any bets placed on Major League Baseball at this point, which whatever part of the story you believe at this point concerning Shohei's involvement in this or not, there were text messages exchanged between the bookmaker and between Ipe, where the bookmaker tries to say, you know, Ipe, after the original article comes out, texts this bookmaker, and the bookmaker says, oh, well, this is, you know, clearly we can see this is a cover-up and you're taking the fall, and the Ipe tries to say, oh, no, well, I actually did steal from him. It's over for me. However you think that sounds and that lands for you, Dad, at the end of the day, the main factor seems to still be pointing back to, as long as there was no money wagered on Major League Baseball, we're avoiding the worst case scenario in this entire ordeal. And that's really, I think, all anyone, Rob Manfred or otherwise, in the league office cares about.
Yeah, I agree. Listen, the gambling is illegal in California, so from that side of it, it was wrong. You're working with an illegal bookmaker. That is wrong, but you're right. It wasn't on your sport, because now, as gambling is becoming legal, we can see you can do it on other sports, just like we talked about in baseball, but just not on baseball. I don't think Shohei's going to be in any trouble here, wherever this investigation goes. However you want to look at it, I'm sure there are going to be people, we know, Mike, that are going to think Shohei has a fall guy here, right? And he's going to take care of him. And that Shohei was actually in on this, which would blow my mind, given you know, the money the guy makes. So I don't know, obviously, enough about this situation, but it does seem that Shohei is not going to be in any trouble at all in this. Mm. And this is just at some point going to go away, and it's going to be the interpreter getting into whatever trouble he's going to get into.
That seems to be where this is centered on, because you're right. Again, this all goes back to a subject that, because we know so little about Shohei Ohtani, we have a really hard time grappling with what we might actually think this person could be capable of, or what could happen in his situation, because so much of what's gone on with him has been kept behind this gate his entire career. That's all his personal information, let alone how he would deal in something like this, who, for anyone, again, that might have missed this at the beginning, Ipe Mizuhara is a guy that Shohei's known since he was a young man getting into all this. He's 10 years his senior. They've been described as incredibly close friends in addition to the business relationship that they have. And so this guy having access to his accounts, this guy apparently, now investigators saying, through phone records that they've got, Mizuhara falsely identifying himself as Ohtani to trick bank employers into authorizing transfer, all this stuff that big time illegal, regardless of what their relationship is. And sounds like will absolutely be the thing that brings him down, still doesn't do anything, I think, to clarify the nature of the relationship and the truth at the center of this for some people. But Dad, the mountain of evidence that we've got now just seems to support that, yes, this guy seems like he's going to go to jail or have at least some punishment levied for all of this. And Shohei Ohtani is going to be allowed to keep playing baseball, but Dad, not without, I think, this certain cloud always associated with him, even if it's not the first thing that we're going to bring up, even months from now, if the Dodgers keep going on the pace that they've started this season at.
It's not. You're right. This is going to become kind of an afterthought. This is going to be kind of, oh yeah, Shohei was involved, you know, in this situation. It's going to turn out I don't think he's going to get in trouble. So yeah, just like it's not going to be the main thing you talk about with Shohei. It's going to be an afterthought on him. I think eventually, and to Rob Manfred and baseball's, I'm sure, joy, that's how it's going to end up. Because when this first came out, I mean, my God, the guy who signs the biggest contract of all time, and then all of a sudden is the headline for a betting scandal, could not be worse for the game we're talking about, the integrity of the game. I mean, that, what a bombshell that day that had to be for Rob Manfred and baseball. But I think there's no doubt that they're gonna escape this.
Well, in Ipe's defense here, one of his alleged texts to the bookies, he says, "I'm terrible at the sports betting thing, huh? LOL." Like, what an all-time quote and a new meme that absolutely went platinum yesterday on Twitter.
Well, between that and then the text message exchange where he talks about he's been messing around with soccer, because again, the focus of this was, what sports was he betting on? What was going on here? And as long as it wasn't baseball, Dad, I'm with you. Technically, in the Major League Baseball, you know, Players Association, their collective bargaining agreement, if you're doing any dealings with an illegal bookmaker or if you're betting on baseball, you in their eyes are guilty of something that would warrant punishment. And so while that was here morally and the ways that we're worried about this existentially for the sport, if it was even Shohei Ohtani betting with an illegal bookmaker but not betting on baseball, I think for most of us, that's something where it's like, all right, you're an adult. That's your money. You make a ton of it. And so if you're comfortable with that, then as long as you're not betting on Major League Baseball, I kind of am going to throw my hands up and go, all right, that's the way the news goes. But in this as that subject was all the way around it. We had the text message exchange where Ipe says, quote, "I've been messing around with soccer. There's games on 24/7, LOL. I took UCLA, but they lost outright." People actually went back and looked and noted that when these text messages were sent in 2021, UCLA soccer was on a tear and wasn't losing games then. And they actually think he was referencing the UCLA and Fresno State banger of a game where Jake Haener, one of my favorite college quarterbacks in recent memory, went off for 455 yards in a game where they came back and won 40-37. So at the very least, we know he had great taste in content because we were all dialed in on that game and it was awesome.
It was. Listen, this guy's going to be forgetting the gambling part of it. I mean, to go into now, listen, Shohei may not press charges. That doesn't mean nothing's going to happen to him because they have all this evidence against him. You know, they could still obviously go after him, but you wonder if Shohei is going to do things now to help him because they were longtime friends. And you just wonder where that's going to go. I don't think it's going to help the interpreter in the long run with the mounds of evidence against him. But, you know, a lot of times you have someone that goes after him, said, "I'm pressing charges, hit him with everything you can." You know, I don't know if Shohei is going to do that. Dude's still going to be obviously in a lot of trouble, but it'll be interesting to see where it goes. But clearly not the headline that's going to worry baseball anymore.
Yeah, once the feds get involved, you've got a lot to worry about. And so with that being the source of this and the bank fraud he's accused of by the feds, or I should say a complaint accusing Ipe of bank fraud, carries a max fine of up to $1 million and or up to 30 years in prison, according to federal sentencing guidelines. There's a long way to go between then and now. And yeah, Dad, I will be fascinated for the people that thought that this might be a situation of a Fall Guys situation and would he be taken care of, or just, you're right, from the relationship standpoint, what this looks like going forward, as I'd imagine it's probably in Shohei's best interest, no matter his level of, you know, perceived guilt or not. If at this point we're just going to operate under what we have evidence-wise, Shohei Ohtani has so far been absolved of any wrongdoing in this situation and looks like he will continue to be. And if you were someone else advising him now, it would be in his best interest to no longer associate with this person who's been tied to the one headline that could stain an otherwise incredibly already successful career and one that shows even more promise now going forward, as he got paid the King's ransom, as the Dodgers are the team to beat in Major League Baseball as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. And part of Shohei may say, listen, to me, that the money he stole was like somebody finding change in their sofa. So no big deal.
Yeah, it must be nice.
Stop it.